What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to episode 21 of Star Wars Beneath Twin Suns, a Massive Breakdown podcast. We have a fantastic episode for you today. Actually going to try to record two episodes today, but we're going to be talking about episode 3 of Book of Boba Fett, perhaps the most polarizing of all of the Book of Boba Fett episodes that have come out so far. I know some people absolutely hated it, hated some specific parts about it, but we're going to talk about the whole episode. We're going to tell you about some trivia, some references, all the good stuff, and I think I might be alone here, but I don't think I dislike this episode as much as a lot of other people in the community seem to. I've actually watched it 3 times, and outside of a couple of specific things, I thought it was a pretty good episode. I really enjoyed it. How'd you feel about it?
So I was pretty iffy on it the first time through. It's just something about the episode as a whole felt just not as strong to me as episode 2 did. That said, I did rewatch it and I enjoyed it a lot more in the second go around. I think part of that maybe was I sort of knew what to expect going in. And so I was able to just kind of relax. And I think part of the issue here is that there are a lot of subverted expectations going on in the wider community that are really throwing people for a loop, because I mean, we know what happens when, you know, you subvert someone's expectations. It can go two ways. Either it surprises them in a good way or it surprises them in a bad way. And either way, you get a very strong reaction.
And if there's one thing that we know the Star Wars community is not really a huge fan of, it is subverted expectations.
That would be a fact, sir.
I found the same thing. I was thinking about this last night. So I rewatched episode 4 last night as well. And I was thinking, like, weirdly, the Book of Boba Fett, I've watched every episode with the exception of episode 4. I've watched every episode 3 times already, which is crazy because I don't think anyone thinks the Book of Boba Fett is as good as Mandalorian so far, or is as good as some of the best Clone Wars or Rebels stuff. But the rewatchability to me has just been really high. Like, I haven't felt at all like it was a chore to rewatch these episodes.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've rewatched them again just because I wanted to rewatch them a third time. And that's almost a little strange to me. It's like, well, it might not be hitting the peaks that some of the other shows have. I'm finding it really easy and, in fact, enjoyable to rewatch the episodes, which I didn't even do that with Mandalorian. Like, I rewatched the Mandalorian episodes a second time before we did the podcast and to watch them with my fiance. But, like, you know, and I enjoyed them on a rewatch, but I wasn't, like, driven to rewatch them, right? Like, I was rewatching them because we were doing the podcast on them. With this, like, last night I rewatched episode 4 just because I wanted to rewatch episode 4. And I rewatched episode 3 for a third time just because I wanted to do it. Even though, yeah, I didn't need to do it for the podcast. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I agree. They have been very easy to rewatch. I think part of it is that this is just it's kind of a very chill Star Wars show in a lot of ways. And some of these slower pacing adds to that. It makes it something that you can just kind of kick back. And you don't necessarily have to be hanging on every line, because the lines are very clear and direct, and there's a lot of, I think, solid use of action, not in the sense of like explosions and firefights, but what people are doing clearly communicates what's going on throughout the show. And so you can kind of relax and just watch. And that makes it very fun to just put on and crack a beer or a coffee, depending on the time of day. Maybe both. I don't know. I don't judge. And you can just kind of kick back and rewatch. So,
yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's like you don't some of the sequels had this issue, and we won't talk about the sequels. I know we don't want to do that. But where, like, if you missed a line, like, a substantial portion of the rest of the movie just wouldn't make sense.
Yeah.
Because you'd miss something that had been said. And this show is not that. In fact, if you pay really strong attention to it, you basically just pick up additional details that don't actually really have any effect on the story, but they're linkings to, like, I just watched Return of the Jedi the other day. Went to go see it at the Symphony, and the Symphony actually played the music to Return of the Jedi while the movie played in the background. It was an incredible experience. But there's so much that I was able to connect having watched Return of the Jedi. Obviously, that's when they go visit Jabba the Hutt's palace and they go out on a sail barge and Boba Fett gets thrown into the Sarlacc pit. And like, there's so many connections between that and this show. It was really cool to see, like, wow, they were very faithful in their recreations of Jabba's palace. Like, the creatures that you see outside in the brief establishing shots are the same. The little droid walking around with a brain in a glass bulb underneath it. Like, that's in Jabba's palace. When you walk in the first time, that little droid walks past. Like, there's so many cool connections. That stuff doesn't actually like change the story of Book of Boba Fett, but it's additional details that make the watch through more enjoyable. And every time I've watched it a second and a third time, I've picked up more of those details. Some of them are subtle. Some of them are kind of in your face. And the fourth episode was the same way. One of our listeners did remind us that we need to avoid spoilers for the following episode if we were talking about, so we're not going to talk about episode four at all. This one,
that's right.
We made that mistake with episode two. This is purely episode three. So spoilers for episode three, but you don't have to worry about spoilers for episode four or anything like that. So I've just enjoyed watching it and picking out some additional details, you know, watching some new stuff. So it's been pretty good. I guess before we get too deep into it, we do need to, as usual, thank our Patreons. Remember, guys, without the patrons, this show would not be happening. It would not be off on its own feed. We also need to thank the people who left us reviews. I believe since the last time, I might have called you out last time. I honestly don't remember. I think I called you out on Destiny Massive Breakdowns, but Captain Reg left us a review and Sergeant Skimmer left us a review.
Awesome.
So thank you very much, guys, for leaving us reviews. Remember, we are trying to push to get up to 36 reviews or 36 ratings. Doesn't have to be reviews. But if you can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or Spotify, that helps us immensely with discoverability. We'd really appreciate it. So that being said, for episode three, I guess the best place to start, I mean, do you want to go out of order? Do you want to start at the beginning? I feel like there's an elephant in the room with episode three that almost needs to be talked about, which is the reception of the youth, of the street gang from Tatooine.
Yeah, I think it would behoove us to go out of order for episode three. Let's open by talking about the mod kids, because honestly, that's when this episode first aired. That's all anyone could talk about. They've been dubbed Power Rangers, travesties, all manner of epithets have been thrown their way, which I think, you know, I understand where people are coming from, because the bright colors and the obtrusive cybernetics do stand out in a big way. They absolutely do. They are jarring. Now, you know, a lot of people have taken that and been like, they thought this was going to fit into Star Wars and it doesn't. It doesn't fit the Star Wars we know and love, and so it's not Star Wars. And that has been a thing that has been said about every new piece of Star Wars since the original trilogy. And you just wait 10 years and then suddenly it is Star Wars. So I think we need to move past that first. We're just going to skip right over, because that claim is very, very much just gatekeeping. And I think we need to talk about where this is coming from, why we think they may have gone this way, how this fits into the overall Star Wars universe, and look at it from that angle. And I think it takes on a very different tone. Now, first off, criticize Robert Rodriguez as a director if you don't like his style, you don't appreciate his thematic choices. I think that's an area where you can reasonably disagree with the man, but trying to argue that he did this by accident, that he thought that this wouldn't stand out and be jarring, I mean, that's just denial. Like, obviously, he knew that this was going to be jarring and this was going to stand out. Everyone involved could not fail to realize that bright colors on a brown background are going to pop. And like these people do this professionally. Okay, you're not the first one to notice. It was intentional. They did it on purpose to shock you. And you fell right into the trap and then acted like a child about it. So, or hopefully you didn't, you know. I don't want to accuse you, the generic listener, of that. But you, the reactionary Star Wars fan who got really, really upset about this, take a breath. It's okay. All right? If you decide you don't like Boba Fett, you don't have to count it.
Yeah, you can headcanon it right out of there. So I posted a Twitter thread about this because at the time, and like it's calmed down with the release of episode 4, a week has passed. Like it's calmed down. The reaction to those characters has calmed down. But when the episode first came out, I feel like a lot of people missed the forest for the trees. And the trees they were focusing on for the most part were three things. One was the kind of slow feeling chase scene that they filmed between the mod kids and the majordomo of the mayor running away. What did we talk about in episode 1, right? We said this is just how Robert Rodriguez does things. Everything he does harkens back to like late 80s, early 90s, like Power Rangers style action. That's how he does stuff. The chase scene is filmed 100% in Robert Rodriguez's style. If you watch like TV shows from the early 90s, like Power Rangers, when they do chase scenes and stuff, it looks, you know, spot for spot like this. It is not an oversight. Like you said, it is not on accident. That's how he chooses to shoot things. Now, is that a fair criticism? Sure. You don't have to like the way he does it. I personally don't really like that style. However, it doesn't detract anything from the story to have a slow chase scene. You know, like the story still progresses as it would. It doesn't actually hurt the story. It is purely a thematic choice and that's it. And it's a thematic choice that really only lasts for about a minute and a half and then it's done. And there's a couple of really fun little Easter eggs that are thrown in there. Yeah. And so to me, it's like if your biggest issue with the show is that the chase scene felt slow, that's really that to me, that doesn't mean it's a bad episode, right? Like, you know, if we had issues with the episode that we talked about before with story things that it did that we didn't really much like, that I feel like is a much bigger issue. Like the actual reason why I think it's the worst issue this season is because of story choices that they made, not necessarily because of thematic things. But the second biggest issue was they were like, oh, the mod kids don't fit in. Why? Their Vespas are brightly colored. This brings me to two of the criticisms I have of the Star Wars community that they do over and over. They did it with the prequels. They did it with the sequels. They've done it at various points with Boba Fett, with Clone Wars, with Mandalorian. But for some reason, a lot of people in the Star Wars community have a very difficult time making a like logical jump to explain something themselves if the show does not explicitly lay it out for them, right? So we've talked about it before, but like a lot of times a show has to lampshade something. Be like, I know this is going to stand out to you. Here's why it stands out. And that's fine and people appreciate it. But they don't always have to do that, particularly in, you know, something where there's a compressed time limit or they have to get a bunch of stuff out or they just don't really feel like doing it. People were like, oh, that stands out on Tatooine. It doesn't fit in. And it's like, okay, well, if you had to make one guess why a bunch of angsty teenagers and young 20-something people who have cybernetic enhancements that are visible, not covered up, would paint their Vespas bright colors. If you were an asshole kid on Tatooine and you wanted to stand out, what color would you paint your Vespa?
Yeah.
Right? Like it is literally, this is something that gets replicated in the UK and Russia and America, everywhere. Like youth, when they want to stand out from their surroundings, don the flashiest clothes and get the brightest colored, loudest cars. Like, if you were on Tatooine and you wanted to stand out as a kid, you would make yourself look like you were from Coruscant. And that's what they did. And it brings me to the second criticism. People are like, this isn't Star Wars. And I hate when people use that criticism, right? Because Star Wars is a great many things. There's pretty much almost anything in the world, if you put it in Star Wars, would fit into some aspect of Star Wars media somewhere. Star Wars has done horror. They've done comedy. They've done slapstick. They've done drama, they've done westerns, they've done samurai stuff. Like, almost anything can be Star Wars. Shit, George Lucas put a 50s diner in the prequels, right? Almost anything can be Star Wars. These people don't fit in on Tatooine, but if you saw them on Coruscant, you wouldn't even bat an eye. They would fit right in on Coruscant. This is Star Wars. It doesn't fit in on Tatooine. Like you said, that was by design.
Yeah.
It was intended. And I'm sorry that Boba Fett didn't say something like, oh, why'd you guys paint your scooters bright colors? And then the kid said, oh, because we wanted to stand out, because that's shitty dialogue. And like, you don't actually want that in the episode. But, you know, come on, guys, if you got really upset about them standing out, it takes like 1 second of actually thinking like, oh, if I was 22 years old, why would I paint my Vespa bright red when I live on a desert planet? It's like, oh, because I want to stand out and I'm an asshole kid. Like, doesn't that just make sense? Isn't that like, to me, when I saw that, that was the first thing I thought. There wasn't even like a hesitation. I was like, oh, I know what these kids are.
Yeah.
Like, I know what these kids are trying to do.
And as for why their stuff is clean, like that, I thought, oh, well, they just stole a week's worth of water. Like, they aren't drinking all of that. They're washing their friggin' bikes.
I mean, you know, you go into a, into like, I went to a school in Florida. We have these things called magnet schools. I don't know if it's something that's nationwide, but basically it's schools that are in like low income areas and they bus people in from different areas and they're trying to like bring up the economic status of a neighborhood, right? By putting like a very good school in a not so great neighborhood. Right. And obviously that plan doesn't end up working out very well. So what you end up getting is you get a bunch of, you know, like kids from better neighborhoods going into a worse neighborhood, right? And you go into these worse neighborhoods and a lot of times the homes look ramshackle and run down and, you know, it's not a great place, but you know what you see? Bright ass, like restored Chevy Impalas that are like purple with flames on the side, sitting in their driveway, sitting on huge rims, right? Big ass sound systems, like brand new Mercedes, super bright colored, lime green Camaros and stuff like that. Like in a not so nice neighborhood, you see a bunch of people who have super flashy cars, right? And the whole thing is that's a juxtaposition. Like the car doesn't fit in that neighborhood. And like to me, and maybe it's because I have that experience, but when I saw those things, I wasn't like, these don't fit in. This makes me angry. I was like, oh, these don't fit in. They must be doing this on purpose. Like the director chose to do this on purpose and the characters have a reason for doing this. So
yeah.
It bothered me that so many people got really upset about that. Cause on my first watch through, it didn't even register with me that that was something that people would be upset about. It seemed like it made sense. And then I come onto Reddit afterwards and people are freaking out. This isn't Star Wars. This doesn't fit in, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, guys, come on. You don't need the characters to tell you the reason they do every single thing, do you?
In retrospect, actually, it sort of makes less sense now that swoop bike gangs don't have flames painted on their bikes.
Right.
In every case. But if you look back, like the pod racers, and I know not everyone is a big fan of the Phantom Menace, but the pod racers were all huge and brightly colored. And there is, in reality, a pretty strong tradition, at least here in the States. You know, I can't speak to everywhere, but I have a feeling that it's pretty standard that if the place that you live is not great, that often you do take pride in certain possessions and your means of transport is very often a way to express that pride. You know, I lived in Kansas City for a long time and I had a friend who lived in a fairly low income area. But there was a huge street racing scene and, despite, you know, not having a ton of money, he had personally rebuilt two Camaros, both of which he still owned, one of which was terrifying to be in. So yeah, like it's a thing. People get flashy with their rides, and I think we've harped on that enough, but
yeah. And if you want some additional info about what they're trying to mimic, there's something called the mod scene from like the 60s and 70s UK. And it was basically like these kind of upper crust youth that were rebelling against their parents and against society and everything like that, got themselves Vespas, tricked them out, put 15 mirrors down the side of them, right? Like there's two main mod characters. There's the guy with the prosthetic eye, and then there's the girl with the prosthetic arm. The girl with the prosthetic arm has like 12 mirrors on her blue scooter.
Yeah.
And it looks like real dumb, right? That is literally almost lifted directly. If you Google mod scooters or like mod culture, you will find pictures. Specifically, most of them probably come from a movie called Quadrophenia that The Who did back then.
Yep.
But you will find pictures of these scooters that have like 15 mirrors on each side, and they look completely ridiculous. Like it is directly influenced by that culture. That's why they made their scooters bright colors. That's why they modified them in seemingly ridiculous and pointless ways. That's why they dress the way they dress, is because they are basically taking that culture and just transferring it into Star Wars. And I posted an article both on my Twitter thread and in the Discord that I highly, highly recommend you read, because it draws the comparisons between the two and it goes deeper into what mod culture was. And as soon as I read that article, even the minor stuff that had bothered me, like, I was like, it's pretty dumb. She's got legitimately like 9 mirrors on each side of her scooter. And then the very first picture of the mod scooter I saw was a scooter that had like 9 mirrors on each side. And they're even laid out in the similar way. And I was like, oh, okay. So it's a reference to something.
Yeah. Cool.
And, you know, and I was able to just like bypass that. Now, I think the third thing that people had issues with, and this is much smaller than the other two, is the cybernetic enhancements that these kids like openly flaunt and openly wear. And I heard some weird stuff like, that doesn't happen in Star Wars. People, there's no cyborgs. And I was like, well, excuse me, Luke Skywalker, cybernetic hand, Anakin Skywalker, almost entirely cybernetic except for his core body, right? Like you looked up a list. But I think what people are weirded out by is most of the time when people get a cybernetic enhancement, they disguise it or they hide it because they're kind of terrifying. But these kids, as we already know, are the opposite of wanting to hide stuff. They want to flaunt it. They want to shove it in people's face. And you found a list that just, there's a ton of characters.
There are a lot of characters in extended Star Wars media and even in core Star Wars media that we've covered on this show that are cybernetic and that are openly cybernetic. So just some of the highlights that I think people are more likely to recognize. So Knights of the Old Republic, the amazing RPG video game from years and years ago that I believe is getting a re-release and a remastering this year. So Darth Malak, a Dark Lord of the Sith, prosthetic voice box that he used to speak in a metallic jaw. Openly cybernetic. Now, he's a Sith Lord, so he's supposed to be terrifying. And that's sort of, I think we're very used to seeing scary characters be more cybernetic, and so we associate it with being evil. But that's, you know, as I think somebody pointed out, that's a bit ableist to assume that just because someone has a cybernetic limb that they are inherently bad or evil. And so I think there's an assumption there that needs to be examined. That said, General Grievous had almost his entire body replaced by cybernetic parts. We saw in his lair over time, he became more and more machine, sort of a Clone Wars stand-in for what Darth Vader would become. Speaking of, Anakin Skywalker, of course, prosthetic arm after his fateful duel with Count Dooku. Bounty hunter Cad Bane. Pair of cybernetic tubes connected to his skull to help him breathe. So I had always thought that was just something he was wearing. But it is, in fact, cybernetic. Let's see. Darth Maul, of course, classic example. In the Clone Wars and Rebels, cybernetic legs. Originally, spider legs. Those were fairly obvious. Later, his mechanical legs given to him by the Witches of Dathomir were a bit less obvious and became sort of less so over time as he started to wear pants again, which we can all be grateful for, I guess. Clone Commander Wolf lost his right eye to Asajj Ventress during the Battle of Korm. He later received a silver prosthetic eye to replace it. Darth Vader, obvious, We know the line. He's more machine than man, per Obi-Wan. Let's see. Who else? Luke Skywalker, of course, following in the footsteps of his father, losing a hand in a duel and having it replaced. In the extended universe, in Star Wars Legends, Boba Fett actually had a prosthetic left leg because he lost his left leg below the knee in the Sarlacc. So not the case here. Would have made it a lot more difficult for him out there in the desert, but that's how it happened in the Legends books. And I think that more or less wraps up the names that people are likely to know, but there are a lot of other examples from Legends of people having cybernetics, both obvious and not so obvious. So it really, we know they have the technology, right? just from big name characters. So to assume that there wouldn't be cultures out there where cybernetics would be more common is, I think, a huge, like, that's a leap. To say that cybernetics aren't common in the Star Wars universe. There are probably, you know, 1 in 10 characters walking around on Tatooine at least have some replacement limb, and you just can't tell because they cover it up. Because that's sort of the standing culture in Star Wars, is you don't flaunt your cybernetics. Which is why the mod kids make even more sense, because they're kids, and what do kids do? They act like jerks, right? Whatever adults don't want you to flaunt, you flaunt.
So all that being said, like, I feel like we addressed the biggest criticisms of this episode. And to me, having now watched the episode multiple times, I don't consider those things to be criticisms of the episode anymore, at least not in a fundamental way that made me dislike the episode. We're going to get into the story, obviously. What actually made me not really like the episode a ton, and having watched the next episode, it improved the third episode for me. No spoilers there, but I'm just saying that. Just factually, it did. They took a bunch of these characters that they had introduced, and then they just like immediately were like, oh, just kidding. Like, none of these characters matter. Like, that was actually what bothered me most about episode three, was that we had the Tuskens for the first two episodes. You know, spoilers, by the way, if you guys haven't watched episode three, like, this, we're getting into story territory now. This is going to spoil it for you. They kill off all the Tuskens, or they make it seem like all the Tuskens are killed.
A lot of them, at the very least, are dead.
Yeah.
And the rest are vanished.
We know for a fact that the leader is dead because we see his body. And we see the stick of the child, although we don't necessarily see the child's body. We don't necessarily see the female Tusken that was the fighter. So who knows what happened? Could be they're still alive, could be they're not. It's implied and shown to us that most of them, if not all of them, are dead. The Tuskens were a big part of episodes 2 and 3. They now have fundamentally served just to be slaughtered again, like the Zan people did in the prequels in Attack of the Clones. Then the twins, which were freaking awesome. The twins come and go in seemingly like half an episode.
So on the Tuskens, it felt to me like they wanted us to think that they were all dead. But because there were these huge omissions of certain characters, it feels to me like they're dropping a pin in that and saying, we're going to come back to this. And it's going to make a difference later in the season. It almost felt heavy-handed to me, but I think it did go over a lot of people's heads, so maybe it wasn't as heavy-handed as I took it. But the implication to me here in Chapter 3 is that we may see the Tuskens again. That's the foreshadowing I'm taking, is that some of them, because there weren't enough bodies, right? He talked about they vastly outnumber the speeder gang, but then we just don't see that many of them. And so my impression is that, you know, the leader got killed. A bunch of them got killed in a surprise attack. And the rest of them fled into the deep desert.
Or were captured or enslaved or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Something has happened to them where we're likely to come back to it. Now, that's my impression. I could be wrong. And we don't, you know. We have no way really to know, but it felt to me like Boba was supposed to get the impression that they had all been killed. You know, and he, despite being his usual stoic self, may not have been in the emotional place, given his experiences, to stop and count the bodies. Especially not while he's burning them, and, you know, we know that he spent a lot of time with them. There is a huge time skip between when he's a prisoner and he first helps the kid to when he's being made part of the tribe. And we know this because it goes from immediately after the escape from the Sarlacc. He's a prisoner. He helps the kid. And then when he visits he goes to Mos Eisley, right? Mm-hmm. In chapter 3 here, We've got stormtrooper helmets being pounded onto pikes, so we know that the Death Star has been destroyed. And so that is a pretty significant chunk of time. I don't know exactly how long it is in Return of the Jedi, but I think we can assume that, you know, it's not like on the order of a week or two. Like, there's a lot that happens.
I think it's like 5 years, or it's like 4 or 5 years is the time that it takes from him being captured by the Sand People to the Sand People being slaughtered. I think it's about that long, which the story doesn't, you know, it doesn't provide clear timetables, because Star Wars never really provides clear timetables.
Right.
It's kind of up to the people to determine the timeline for themselves. And that's one of these things where I feel like a lot of people felt like, oh, it's weird. How long was he with the Sand People? He was with the Sand People for a long time.
Yeah.
Years and years and years. And so them being slaughtered after spending time with these people for, let's say it was 4 years, which is on the shorter thing. I actually think it was probably longer than that. But let's say he's with them for 4 years. That's basically been his family for 4 years. They've taken care of them. He's taken care of them. And if not all of them were slaughtered and some of them escaped, I think he feels that they wouldn't want to see him again, because he basically brought this on them. He convinced them to attack the train.
Right.
He basically brought them into conflict with, at least with the Nikto Sand Riders, but potentially with the Pikes as well.
Right.
I think that's also a little bit of foreshadowing that, like you said, well, they vastly outnumber the Nikto Sand Riders. How is it that they were able to wipe them out or drive them away? And I think this is being a little bit heavy-handed, but I would assume that the Nikto Sand Riders did not do it on their own, that the Pikes probably also were like, oh, this is a golden opportunity for us. Let's pit these two against each other. Maybe they'll wipe each other out. We won't have to pay protection to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, so I saw Paul Tassi wrote, like, the biggest twist of Book of Boba Fett season is really obvious. And it's like, I don't think that's supposed to be a twist. I think that they're very heavily alluding to that in the story. Like, a twist is something you don't see coming. I think anybody who's been paying attention sees it coming, that the Nikto Sand Riders either had help or there were some extenuating circumstances going on there.
Well, and there's, you know, we know the Pikes are manipulative and shadowy from past media. They don't play fair, right? They're a criminal organization. The thought that they would play fair is patently ridiculous. So it is entirely likely that they even reinforced the Sand Riders, because they would probably rather deal with their own kind, criminals who they understand, than the Tusken Raiders who they do not understand.
And who they consider savages for the most right. part.
Yeah. You know, so that was also a thought in the back of my mind, is perhaps the Pikes did this themselves and just put, you know, it was a false flag operation. That was the other option that came to mind to me, is the Pikes did this and they just put the symbol of the Nyctos on the tent to be like, oh, well, now you know who did it. But do we? Do we know who did it? We don't. We weren't there.
That's one of the hard parts about doing live reviews of these shows as they come out, is that there is something that could happen in the future, in the next 3 or 4 episodes, that dramatically changes how I feel about the conclusion. I'm saying this with air quotes, the conclusion of the Tusken storyline in Book of Boba Fett.
Right. Right?
But looking at the episode in isolation, regardless of the foreshadowing that it has for future episodes, like just taking episode 3 in a bubble, I wasn't super happy with the conclusion of the Tusken storyline. Now, if they change something about that in a future episode, I'll revisit it. One of my criticisms of this episode will be invalid, and I'll enjoy the episode more. But the twins was the same way. Like, I thought the twins were really, really cool characters. They come in and out in the second half of episode 2, and then they're gone in the first half of episode 3.
I wholeheartedly agree about the twins. That was a jarring story choice, to have them suddenly show up, make this strong front assassination attempt, and then, like, immediately after the assassination attempt fails, they're like, you know what, we're out. That feels like one of two things is happening. Either they're backing off for now and planning to try and take out whoever sort of survives what they seem to think is going to be a bloody conflict. But then they tell Boba Fett to leave as well. Perhaps they know that he won't. It's always hard to tell with Hutz. But it felt really weird for them to appear and then disappear. It felt rushed. And it honestly, I almost wish that they hadn't been in the story at all, because it was jarring from a story standpoint for them to vanish like that. That said, they did provide an opportunity to introduce Kersantan, who I think is a character that we're going to see more of. It would be shocking to me if we don't see a lot of Kersantan in the rest of the season, based on the beginning of Chapter 3. I guess we haven't talked about the assassination attempt at all.
We're all over the place on this episode.
But. Yeah, it is. Well, so let's finish up with the twins. I don't know that there's much more to say. They're there. They make a huge splash, get everyone excited for some Hutt villains, and then they're like, actually, we're going to peace out, and if you're smart, you'll do the same.
The difficulty of being in charge of the early episodes in a continuous storyline season, right? Like, Book of Boba Fett's not really episodic. Like, Clone Wars and, you know, Rebels, to a certain extent, they're episodic. Like, there may be overarching storylines, but they either wrap up in the arc or they wrap up in the episode itself. With Book of Boba Fett, as we've watched more episodes, I'm really getting the feeling that it's almost meant to be binged. Like, it's kind of like The Witcher, right? Where it's like meant to be connected episode to episode to episode. It's almost like an 8-hour movie or something like that, as opposed to you can kind of just watch episodes out of context. You know, with Rebels or Clone Wars, you can kind of just watch a random episode and you'll get a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it may fit in somewhere in the grand scheme, but same with Star Trek The Next Generation, right? And Picard wasn't that way. Modern storytelling has evolved into a way where they want these continuous overarching storylines. The problem with these early episodes is that they have to build these storylines and then they have to leave some of them hanging. Yeah. And what you're left is you're left hoping for a conclusion of those storylines later in the season. But in isolation, it can come off a little bit disappointing. And that's the issues that I had with Chapter 3, is that it felt like they were either concluding or cutting off a couple of storylines, and should they be picked up in the future, then it won't matter, right? That criticism will no longer be valid. But for right now, when we don't have episodes, you know, 4, 5, 6, and 7 to talk about, I was like, oh damn, like, I like the twins. I like Kersantan. I like the Tuskens. And now they're all just seemingly gone. And so that was the biggest issue that I had with episode 3. I know some people criticize the Kersantan fight with Boba, and they were like, he could have just stabbed him when he was in the Bacta tank. And it's like, if you want someone stabbed in their sleep, you don't send a giant ass Wookiee to do that. That's not what Wookiees do.
Yeah.
That's not how Wookiees kill. Wookiees don't creep softly up and then just, you know, poison them or stab them in their sleep. Like, Wookiees throw them around the room and rip some arms off and they break some shit. Like, they sent Kersantan for a reason, and it was to make a mess. It was not, you know, killing Boba Fett, good, paralyzed Boba Fett, whatever. It was basically to send a message. And it was that we want to cause a ruckus over here, not slip someone quietly in and have Boba Fett die in his sleep.
The one real criticism that I do have for the fight scene, the one thing that I wish they had just not done at all, I think the fight scene would be better if they had left out, even if they went back and cut it out, is when he is squeezing him. Because I'm just like, he's just adjusting his back, right? At this point, yeah. He's almost helping Fett, because we know he's not going to break his back. We didn't know that at the time. I was a little concerned, but then he didn't, and I was just like, well, that was pointless and dumb, and they shouldn't have done it.
I actually thought he was going to break his back when he was doing that, and I was like, oh, that's why we met the mod kids. Like, they're going to break his back, and he's going to go get modded. Like, I thought that briefly at first, but then, you know what I realized? I was like, oh, this is some Robert Rodriguez shit again, where like the six-armed creature picks up the Rodian by the head and you're like, oh, he's gonna rip his head off, and then he just doesn't, because it's like a PG, you know, it's a PG TV show basically. It was the same thing with this. Like, Robert Rodriguez wants to break his back, yeah, but he can't do that because of the platform and the show that he's on. So he's like, violence, but not really violence, but like a little bit less violence.
Yeah, and that's part of why I wish they had just left out that specific moment, or at the very least, if they would have just, because it was a little drawn out. Like, it wasn't like he grabbed him and then got stabbed in the back.
No, he's like hugging him for a good bit of time.
Yeah, it was like, okay, given that a Wookiee can rip a man's arm off, it is not conceivable he could have been squeezing him for that long and not done serious, if perhaps not permanent damage in the Star Wars universe, but serious damage. So it should have either been like a momentary move that was immediately interrupted or just not been in the scene at all. That is probably my biggest criticism of the entire episode following the twins' rapid retreat.
I agree 100%. I don't think we're going to have a Robert Rodriguez directed episode that doesn't have criticisms about like fight scenes or action scenes. Like I think he has one more episode for the rest of the season.
Right. Yeah.
And I think just every time he directs an episode, there's going to be criticisms about his action scenes and his fight scenes. Like there are, even in The Mandalorian, which is a great show, and The Tragedy, which is a great episode, there are criticisms about the fighting and action scenes. Like it's just what he does. I don't know if he thrives off of it or if he thinks it's funny or he just doesn't really care because that's his style and he likes it, right? But I think we're going to probably experience this at least one more time throughout this season. So, but like I said, you know, in the end, it doesn't actually negatively affect the story because it's purely an aesthetic thing, right? Like nobody mentions anything. There's no dialogue. You know, if you were to remove that scene or change that scene, it doesn't actually affect the story at all. And so because of that, although I criticize the way it shows, it doesn't really hurt the episode any, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like a character having a haircut that you don't like, or it's like the mod kids having bite colors that you don't like. Like if I could just go in and post-processing and just change the bite colors and you enjoyed it 100 times more, then the truth is it really doesn't matter because it's just the color or it's just the appearance. There's no actual effect on the story at all. And so because of that, I'm like, I hand wave it away a bit. It does annoy me. And when I'm watching it, like I told you, I was watching, I was like, oh shit, he just broke his back. And then he just like walks down in a bathrobe and like goes to dinner. I was like, oh, okay, never mind. He didn't break his back.
Basically. You know, and then we get the Gamorreans show up. They get the crap beaten out of them by Kersantan. So I guess actually I do have one more criticism of this scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fennec shows up and drops him into the Rancor pit, which is fine. All of that's fine. People always manage to stand in the wrong place in Jabba's throne room. It's just, I think the throne room is like designed to like psychologically make you want to stand there. I'm just, that's how I headcanon that.
Well, if it's the center point of the room, right? Like if his throne is somewhere and there's a grating somewhere, like you're not going to voluntarily stand on the grating because you're scared of that. But the grating is actually just what they watch the stuff happening. Yeah. The actual trapdoor itself is disguised. There's sand over the top of it. But I bet it does. I bet the room funnels you in. I bet it's very close to the center, right in front of where the throne would be, which is where people are naturally going to stand.
So that doesn't bother me at all. What does bother me, and this is something that my daughter and I have discussed repeatedly, how did Kersantan get in? Where were the guards?
He climbed up the tower. He climbed up the
tower.
Did he?
Okay.
Yeah. They probably should have elaborated, but in extended media, including what is now canon media, canon stories about the Wookiees and stuff, they are extremely adept climbers. The way they get around on Kashyyyk, which is their home planet, is they actually have like retractable claws that are specifically designed for climbing, and they can crush into the trees on Kashyyyk, like the giant trees have super hard bark. And their claws can like basically grip into the bark, even though it's like as hard as stone, and they can climb up the trees and climb around the trees. So they don't swing on like vines, although I'm sure they do that too, right? But they don't swing on vines like Tarzan. They actually use their claws and they climb up these huge, you know, 1,000-foot-tall trees. So I think the insinuation from that is he literally climbed up the tower from the outside and got into the top of the tower.
I wish they would have just...
Which there would be no guards.
I wish they would
have
lampshaded that because that was confusing.
Yeah.
And that I think a lot of people were thrown off by like, how did he get in? But that does make sense as an explanation. That actually makes a fantastic amount of sense.
Yeah, that maybe should have been something that needed to be lampshaded because that's not like a, although that is kind of the logical jump. If you were like, how does a Wookiee get into a super tall tower without?
For somebody who's not seen Star Wars generally, or maybe actually more accurately, hasn't read a lot of Star Wars extended media, there's no real way to make that leap. Why would you assume that a Wookiee is a good climber? You don't have any particular reason to think that. That really is a leap without some outside knowledge on the Wookiees. So
that's fair.
That was more jarring to me than the mod kids.
Darn you, Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah.
But so I guess we should probably go back to the beginning. But the mod kids, you know, they do stand up well for themselves. I mean, a couple of them get beat up a little bit, but not too badly. But they manage to outnumber the Wookiee, at least between the two Gamorreans and Fett and the four mod kids and Finnick. They manage to capture Krisantan. I guess we should probably roll back to the beginning, because there's actually a scene early on that I really liked in this episode. Actually, there's a number of scenes I really like in this episode. There's a good bit of exposition that explains kind of the setup of Tatooine, but 8D8 is talking to Finnick and Boba, and he's basically explaining what's going on Tatooine, what has happened since Jabba died and Bib took over, and then Boba killed Bib. And he's like, look, the Trandoshans are here, the Aqualish are here, you know, the Pikes are kind of working over here. Like, he's explaining where everyone stands, and I really liked that. I actually thought we could have done with that a little bit earlier in the show.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed that establishment of like, okay, here's the major families, here's the major players, here's who we're dealing with, you know, moving forward.
Absolutely. This did feel like maybe it should have happened sooner during his attempt to seize power. Like, he might have wanted to start off by getting the lay of the land, but it's possible that they had to get some intelligence on exactly how it worked. And, you know, they're talking to a torture droid, not to a protocol droid, so he may not have actually had this information ready to hand. You know, that's sort of, you know, good help is hard to find, right? And so you want the lay of the land, but all you have is a torture droid. You know, it might take a minute to get a presentation put together. So, yeah, it was very helpful, I think, to get the layout for us as viewers at this point in time. And, you know, we do sort of wonder a little bit at why somebody stronger didn't step in. But the twins do give us an insight that, you know, it may simply not have been worth the trouble to try to unseat Bib, who did already have a lot of connections on Tatooine locally. And so it may simply not have been worth the trouble. But then when they thought, okay, there's no one really taking the scene, now it's time to step in.
Well, and they also talk about, like, they don't really want war. Like, they don't want to go to war with the Pikes. They're like, we're not interested in that. I mean, it's probably the Trandoshans, the Aqualish, the Clatonians. They're probably all like, yeah, we've got our places. We're making money. Like, there's no reason to go get a bunch of people killed. Like, there's a precarious balance that is in place. And it just kind of works out better for everyone to not go to battle. You know, Jabba was a strong, strong ruler, capable of ruling basically the entire planet. They were all just captains under him, or, you know, sector leaders. Like, they probably don't have the power by themselves. And going to war with another group is a good way to get them killed, or their people killed, or lose money. So they probably were like, you know what, we're just happy with this for right now. Like, let's just keep things in the balance. Bib's happy, we're happy.
Right.
We've divided up Tatooine into our own little parcels. We'll just hold on to it. But I really like the next scene too, with Steven Root, the little watermonger who comes in.
Yeah.
And is like, nobody, he basically is a stand-in for the audience. He's like, look, man, nobody respects you. Like, you're not going hard out in the streets. The streets are chaos now. I'm being stolen from. Like, people don't really think that you're a strong leader, which is something people have been complaining about in the audience. Like, Boba Fett's not really a great crime lord. And up to this point, he's really not. Now, he's injured and he's trying to find his feet under him and everything like that. And he doesn't really have a strong backing or a lot of support. He's got everything that's in Jabba's palace, which is insinuated to be a significant amount of money and stuff, but not really a ton of manpower, actually. So Steven Root tells him that.
Yeah, and since his time with the Tuskens, he has been apparently reluctant to go out and just kill those that he wants to rule. And I think the implication here, you know, from Steven Root, is that that's sort of the kind of power show that people on Tatooine expect. Like, you don't show up, you know, you're showing up, you're not really making a splash, you are holding back. And this is kind of the complaint of the audience, I think, as well, is that they expected Fett to show up and start blowing people up immediately. And he just didn't do that. He wanted to, he's trying to do something different. He's not the bounty hunter. As he repeatedly tells us on screen, he's not the bounty hunter that he used to be. He's trying to do something different. And it's not going well for him. Trying to change his colors is difficult.
Is it really? It's changing colors from the EU and from the headcanon. But we talked about this in episode one, I think. But is it really changing colors? I mean, we have to remember this Boba Fett is the Clone Wars Boba Fett. The Clone Wars Boba Fett was not an evil person. He was not a mass murderer. He was not a emotionless, remorseless killer. He wasn't any of those things. He was a kid who lost his dad and got taken in by Aurra Sing and the other bounty hunters. And Aurra Sing tries to make him a remorseless killer. And he fights back against that. Now he kills, particularly clones, who I think, for the most part, especially the adult clones, he doesn't feel particularly compassionate for them. But even he feels bad when Aurra Sing straight up executes a clone in front of him and tells him to execute another one. And he can't do it. If you recall this, remember when he plants the bomb trying to kill Mace Windu in the Venator class destroyer, and he escapes with a bunch of his other clone cadets that are all like little kids.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't want to leave them to die, and he doesn't want to execute them. When he's trying to kill prisoners, he doesn't, like, Boba Fett has, in canon, current canon, has never been a remorseless killer. He would kill when he had to, and he would kill when he felt he was wronged, or when he was in a fight if he absolutely needed to, but he never went out of his way looking to kill people.
It's true.
So, and especially having lived with the Tuskens for 5 years, I think that cemented, I think there was always a little bit of a battle between being a badass bounty hunter, which we see in Clone Wars, especially in the later episodes where he's like a teenager now and he's got his, not his Boba Fett armor, but his initial bounty hunter armor. He has this battle between trying to be a hard ass bounty hunter and also trying not to be an awful, awful person. And in public, he errs on the side of hard-ass bounty hunter because that's what you have to do.
Right.
And that's the version of him that we see in The Empire Strikes Back and in the original trilogy. But this version is him having lived with the Tuskens for 5 years and saying, you know, that's not me. That was who I was because I had to be that because I was in the servitude of other people. I don't want to be that anymore. So people are saying, this isn't Boba. This isn't Boba. This is Boba. It may not be your headcanon Boba. It may not be extended universe Boba, but from the Clone Wars until now, this better human being version of Boba is the true one. And, you know, people are going to say, this isn't Star Wars, blah, 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 blah. Well, it is. It's just it doesn't match your headcanon necessarily, or it doesn't match the extended universe. But that doesn't mean that it's incorrect. And maybe what we need to do is maybe we need to go back and pull out all the Clone Wars episodes that have Boba in them and do a special rewatch just of those and come to the conclusion of like, this is who Boba shows he is. Here's example, 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 you know?
Yeah, that may be something that we want to do post this season, I think, is maybe revisit the Boba Fett episodes. I guess it would have been something good to do before this season, but we didn't get to it.
I didn't think the connection was going to be quite so strong between his character, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, so let's keep rolling here. We still have some ground to cover. Roots Watermonger, you know, kind of explains, you know, about the street gang, they're half man, half machine, and he's clearly disgusted by their open flaunting of cybernetics. Which I guess maybe he really is a stand-in for a significant part of the audience here. He's mocking Boba. He is mocking the mods. So I think everyone who feels that way, there's your person, right?
I thought that was the funniest thing. The irony is so strong that he's mocking the mods. He's saying nobody respects Boba. He's like the boomer of the Star Wars universe, right? He literally comes in, he's like, these disrespectful youth, how dare they? And then there's the mirror image of people in the Star Wars community being like, they don't fit in, I hate them, they don't belong on Tatooine. It's like, you are this guy, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, you don't like their brightly colored scooters and you're yelling to the wind about how much you hate the scooters. It's like, this is the standard. The irony is these kids are doing stuff to stand out on Tatooine, and the boomers hate it, and they're complaining about how much they stand out. And it's like, this guy, which Stephen Root, by the way, we talked about this before the show, actually was also in Star Trek TNG. He was a Klingon captain in Unification Part 1 and 2, which is the episode where that Spock is in TNG. So I thought that was kind of fun. He got to be in both of my favorite sci-fi franchises.
Indeed. With certain headshots, he's also a dead ringer for Jon Favreau. Or vice versa, perhaps, whichever way you want to look at it. But I was totally thrown when I saw the headshots, and I was like, wait, isn't that? No, it's not. Wait, but yeah, it really, really confused me for a minute. But he's great. He's great in this scene. And he really does speak the thoughts of a certain portion of the audience. So, you know, again, to think that the people making the show don't know what you're thinking, very arrogant. Like they understand where you're coming from, and they're trying to get you to accept a certain point of view on things. So Fett, naturally being the good daimyo, promises to deal with this scourge, and walks, as is his way, to Mos Espa with Finnick and the Gamorreans. Fortunately for him, things go very smoothly. You know, so we learn that the workers' district is a fairly, you know, it's a term for an area of the city where workers can be found. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have a job. And so they indicate that there is no work to be had, which is a bit ironic coming from them with their shiny, you know, hover bikes and cybernetic parts. Clearly, they're not necessarily in need of work themselves, but it does fit very strongly with a countercultural youth movement that is upset with the old guard. And that is the vibe I get from them, right? They call Fett old man. They say he's just another crime lord. They are disdainful and brash and kind of everything you expect from rebellious kids who think they're invincible.
I really liked his solution of like, oh, there's no work, come work for me.
Yeah.
Like I was hoping in my head that that's what he was going to do, because that is the perfect solution to that problem. Is like, oh, you guys can't find a job and I just caught you stealing, come work for me then.
Yeah.
Because they can't really say no, because then they're, you know, going against what they just said of like, oh, there is no work. We'd love to work, but there is no work.
Right.
It's like, all right, sure, let's go then. And they do. And I actually like that. And of course, they prove their use later in the episode. But I thought that that was a good way to handle it.
You know, and I think this, you know, kind of again continues to highlight some of the struggles that he is having with life on Tatooine. He's clearly very upset about the fact that water is being charged, like is being overcharged for. And he makes his displeasure known to the watermonger. He pays him less than half what he was asking for the water, and he tells him to be happy with it and consider it settled. You know, and that harkens back those dreams of Kamino that he has with the water. That really feels like something is going to come of that his feelings about the scarcity of water, that there's going to be some kind of change that happens in Tatooinean life.
I love those flashbacks to Kamino. And Tatooine used to be covered in water.
Right.
They've said that multiple times. Even the Lorth Appeal, the water vendor, says that, well, Tatooine used to be covered in water.
Yeah.
But it isn't anymore. So they've mentioned that several times. And I guess it fits in with the Dune Sea and everything like that. But so obviously that leads into the assassination attempt by Black Chrysantin. We talked about that. The Hutts show up afterwards. We also kind of talked about that. Probably we just glossed over them bringing him a Rancor with Danny Trejo as the Rancor trainer. And that's a fantastic gift for him, because, you know, that was the one thing he was really missing that makes him a crime lord, is having a Rancor in his dungeon. And Danny Trejo is fantastic. Danny Trejo is actually, I believe he's a cousin of Robert Rodriguez. Like, they're related. And so it's not surprising to see him here, but I'm very happy. I know he's a huge fan of Star Wars, so it's cool to see him finally get a role in the Star Wars universe, and a talking role, too. He kind of explains to Fett that, you know, Rancors are actually emotionally very complex creatures. They're capable of feeling depression, sadness, love, like affection, which explains why in Return of the Jedi, the Rancor Keeper was so sad that the Rancor had been killed. He goes in there and he's the big fat guy is crying, which canon wise, he actually ends up teaming up with Cobb Vanth. That specific Rancor hunter teams up with Cobb Vanth later on in one of the Aftermath books. But Danny Trejo is great. He said that the Rancor is blinded because it will imprint on the first human being that it sees. So Boba Fett stands in front of it, and the Rancor, he basically pets it like it's a, like it's just, you know, a dog or something like that, a big, hungry, vicious dog. And he straight up tells Danny Trejo, like, yeah, I'm trying to ride this thing.
Yeah.
And Danny Trejo is like, that's something that hasn't been, you know, the Witches of Dathomir, which is a link to an EU book called The Courtship of Leia, I believe. And Fett says, well, I've ridden things 10 times this big, which is a link to the Christmas special that Fett appeared in as an animated character riding basically like a brontosaurus or something.
I think it's technically like an ichthyodont, which I don't really know what that means, but you can Google it, I'm sure. It's spelled ichthyodont.
So a lot of like weird EU, you know, linkage right there that if you're just listening and you don't know what it is, like it's just words, right?
Right.
But if you actually do know what it is, it's a nice little throwback to some stuff. So eventually 8DH strolls on in there and is like, hey, man, we got to go. The mayor says he's not going to meet with you for 3 weeks or something.
Now, before we get to the meeting with the mayor, I just remember there's a link to some other Star Wars inspirational material that I want to talk about. And you're, you know, kind of mentioning the flashbacks to Kamino. Brought it back to mind for me. I've been meaning to bring this up for a while, but it's becoming more and more, direct. But there's an extremely strong callback to Dune happening here. Now, Dune, has been, for better or worse, I think, acknowledged as a huge inspiration for Tatooine, and as an inspiration for a number of things in Star Wars. But Tatooine is, of course, the strongest callback, because the story of Dune takes place mostly on Arrakis, which is a desert planet, and has giant sandworms, which, you know, perhaps the Krayt dragons are a bit reminiscent of, to say the least. So, in Dune, the protagonist, Paul Atreides, dreams of water at the beginning of the story, repeatedly. Now, he's from a watery planet as well, the planet Caladan, and his family rules Arrakis at the behest of the Emperor in order to keep the spice trade flowing. So there's massive, massive callbacks going on here. Hugely important. And he dreams of water, and it's a foreshadowing in Dune of the secret underground reservoirs that the Fremen, the desert people of Arrakis, have that no one knows about. Because their hope is to eventually have enough water to terraform Arrakis and make it not a desert planet. And we know that there is hidden water that the Tusken Raiders are aware of in the black fruit. I don't remember what its name is, or if it even has a name other than just...
I think it's literally called the Black Melons.
The Black Melons, yeah. It is. Yeah, you're right. That he does call it that at one point. So the Tuskens are aware of a widely and freely available source of water that apparently no one else is, because you don't see anyone else drinking them. So I feel like there is an intentional reference there. We've got a sort of an heir to the throne of a desert planet dreaming of water, who happens to be aware of a solution to the incredible thirst that the people of that planet are suffering from. I just think it's cool. I think it's a cool parallel, and I'm excited to see where it leads in the future. And if you haven't read Dune and you love weird science fiction and you're listening to this podcast, so there's decent odds, highly recommend reading the books. I hear the new movie is great. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet.
And Dune, very clearly, like, these parallels are on purpose. Dune was a huge inspiration for George Lucas.
Yeah.
Huge. And then back to the story, they leave the Rancor, they go to see the mayor's majordomo, who basically is like, nope, can't meet with him. He's very busy. Very busy. No time. tries to run away, tries to flee. The mods chase him down. Boba flies in with the jetpack. He actually crashes into a carton of Meluan fruits, which if you are familiar with Rebels,
right.
They're Hera Syndulla's favorite fruit that she always sends them off on a mission to go gather Meluans. And he crashes into a carton of those things and tells them, like, the mayor's working with the Pikes. He's gone. Like he, and that echoes what the twins had said, which is the cowardly mayor promised the territory to someone else, and it was the Pikes, pretty much.
Yeah.
So at the end of the episode ends with a giant Starliner coming in, which is really cool, by the way. I really like the Starliner. And a bunch of Pikes getting off of it, and Shad, which is the mod with the prosthetic eye, tells them, like, or Scad, sorry, his name's Scad, tells them, hey, there's at least a dozen Pikes coming in. And Fennec's like, this is just the first wave. Like, they're stocking up to go to war. Like, they're not going to let this territory go without a fight. And Fett tells them they'll be ready. I really liked the end of this episode. I really liked a bunch of stuff, with the exception of the weird conclusions to a couple of storylines that I was interested in, or seemingly the conclusions. I actually really liked this episode. And so, I mean, I still think it was the worst episode of the season. But I don't think it was that bad. I think it was a good continuation of the story. I think it moves some things forward. We kind of are getting pushed in the direction that the Pikes are now the big antagonist for the rest of the season. So, you know, yeah. I mean, I don't think it was nearly as bad as some of the Clone Wars episodes that we've seen in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. No, ultimately it's not a strong episode for a number of reasons as a standalone. Where it fits in the broader story remains to be seen. And it certainly has been polarizing. I think that could be fairly said.
Like I said, having watched episode 4 and then gone back and watched episode 3, and again, no spoilers here, but I enjoyed episode 3 more after having watched episode 4.
That's fair. Yeah.
By a pretty substantial amount. It does address some of the criticisms I have. So I'm hoping that the rest of the season continues to do that. I mean, I'm telling you, as soon as the season's done, I'm going to go back and I'm going to watch all the episodes through as one, basically binging it. And I have a feeling, or at least I'm optimistic, that some of the negative thoughts I had earlier on will go away. But that being said, I mean, I think I was talking on Twitter. I was like, I mean, 4 episodes in, I got to give the show like a 7.5 around there. Like, I think it's a good show. It's not Mandalorian good, but I'm enjoying it. The rewatchability, as I mentioned earlier, super, super high. I mean, by the time this season's done, this will probably be the most I've watched one of the Star Wars shows in terms of numerical number of times I've watched each episode.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I've definitely been rewatching it a lot. Part of that has as much to do, like, the rewatchability is high, which is good, because a lot of times I find myself puzzling over decisions made. And so that is also contributing to my rewatching, because I'm like, but why did they do this?
Yeah.
You know, we'll find out as time goes on why they did certain things. That does bring us, though, to the final step here in our episode. Where do you rate this episode?
Well, let's see. We rated episode 2 a 9. What did we rate episode 1? A 7? Around there? Did we give it a 7.5?
I think it was a 7.5.
I mean, I want to say a 6, but that seems a little low. Maybe like a 6.5. Somewhere around there.
So I was debating anywhere between like 7.5 feels way too high.
Oh, way too high.
I think I would agree with a 6.5. I would agree with a 6.5. This is definitely the weakest episode so far for me. Largely because it felt like, not for the reasons that other people didn't like it, but just because it felt like some weird story choices that don't make a lot of sense right now. And as a standalone episode, it doesn't work as a standalone episode.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think a 7 is just, you know, I consider a 7 to be an average episode, you know, using the school grading system, right? Where a 5 is not an average episode, a 5 is failure. I consider like a 7 to be an average episode. And I think this was a little bit below average. But you know, at the same time, a 6 feels too low because there were some things that I liked about it. Like, I liked the Rancor. I liked 8D8 scene in the beginning. I enjoyed a few good parts of this episode. I like the flashback where he finds the Tuscans dead. I thought that was a beautifully shot scene, really well scored. This beautiful Mandoa chanting in the background, which is actually the Mandalorian language. I actually really enjoyed some of the stuff.
I actually enjoyed the chase scene. I think I'm in a massive minority for saying that. But the reason is that we watch a lot of animated Star Wars in my house, and it felt very, very much like it was ripped straight from an animated chase scene. Those often do feel a bit slower, I think, because of the nature of the animation that's used for Star Wars shows. To me, at least, they often feel slower.
You know what it felt like? It felt like the scene in the first episode of Rebels,
yes,
where Ezra steals the crates and is driving away. And they it felt very, very much like that.
Absolutely.
Going between winding roads and like a city. It felt a lot like that. And I didn't mind it. And I liked the fact that that one of the mods drives through like a plaster painting,
yes,
that they are bringing. And it's literally a Ralph McQuarrie concept art that's been reproduced and modified a little bit. It was originally the concept art of Luke in Jabba's palace, but they remove Luke from it. It's just basically a painting of Jabba, like a plaster painting of Jabba. They're about to hang on the wall, and one of the mods rides right through it.
With Fett featured as a member of the court there. So it's interesting that it's dropped in like that. But yeah, it's I wouldn't mind putting that on my wall.
I think it's got to be a 6.5. I think a 6 is just too low for it. It wasn't that bad of an episode. There have easily been better or worse episodes of Star Wars TV that we've seen.
That's for sure.
Including some of the freaking Jar Jar Binks episodes from Clone Wars. So, yeah, I think 6.5 is fair.
Yep. Okay. Well, there you have it. Chapter 3 of The Book of Boba Fett.
All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back shortly with Chapter 4. Not entirely sure when it's going to release, but we're trying to get back on schedule. I would like to get back to the point where the Monday following the release of an episode, we're releasing an episode talking about it. I know we've been trailing a week behind so far because I had to go and be selfish and go on my bachelor party, but hopefully we're getting back on track this week.
It didn't help that I then proceeded to get COVID. So
yeah. And so we each, you know, did a little something that pushed us behind.
Yeah. Yeah. But we're working on it. We'll be caught up soon. All right. May the force be with you.
Also with you.